All right, I'm Matthew Bosler. Joining me on the line is Patrick Burns, CEO of Overstock.com. How are you doing today, Patrick?
Matthew, great to speak to you.
Likewise. Now, Overstock.com released Q4 2010 earnings results about a month ago, and I want to go back to the earnings conference call for a moment, if I may. You said on the call that Overstock.com is really not chasing the top line growth and that you like the contribution line growth and you like managing your G&A and seeing this great growth in the bottom line. And then you say that if top line growth comes back, it will be from some other, say, smarter factors than through just brute force. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on that.
Sure. We in 09 in 2010 we grew 24% on the top line. Our bottom line grew 79% from $8 million to $14 million gap, and we like that. We like being gap positive, and you know, we could of course put all that profit back into more TV ads, more online advertising, but and grow faster. But we think it's prudent at this point to instead, we're making a lot of investments in technology. We've built a new dev center. We're hiring lots of technologists and mathematicians and stuff. And I think that's a better way for us to get real stick to your ribs value rather than just chasing the top line. So as we make these enhancements to our site and our supply chain and to the different kinds of things we offer, and by the way, there's something coming live on Monday that you'll be interested in. There'll be a new tab, a whole new kind of product offering. As we do this kind of stuff, I think that's the real way to generate for us going forward fundamental growth. We're $1.1 billion last year, and sure, we could just buy a lot more TV ads, but I'd rather see us growing from getting smarter, making our website and our supply chain smarter, and finding ways to drive costs out of the system and such. So that's really more technological driven than straight marketing driven.
Focusing a little bit more on the longer term then is what I hear you saying.
Yeah, well, we always focus on the longer term. I'm a value investor by background, and one of the precepts of value investing is that you only buy a share of stock if and only if you would buy it even if the market were shutting down for 5 years tomorrow. And the corollary is you run a company as if there is no public market. You're always just trying to build. We're always thinking 5 years out. If 3 years out. It's kind of hard to think past 3 years out in this business, but we're always thinking that way and never worrying about quarter to quarter.
Very good. Talk to us about Overstock's new branding initiative with O.co.
Well, late last year, we changed our international presence, and we do have an international presence. It ships to 91 countries. We changed to O.co, and we introduced it as a shortcut into the U.S. market. And our TV ads now, if you pay attention, they're all saying, you know, use O.co as a shortcut to Overstock.com, and to help you remember, we'll give you free shipping if you use O.co. And quite a fair bit of our traffic has shifted to O.co. And it's not out of the question that you could see our brand within the U.S. actually morph into O.co. It's the savings engine. It is, you know, O.co, the savings engine, is sort of a nice, tight, concise way of saying what we do, both to the public and inside the company. And we're thinking of ourselves more and more that way, as a savings engine. We're the place you go. We're not trying to have the full spectrum of products of eBay or Amazon, but we're what we have. We have, you know, found great, we can deliver with great value. So we're really just about generating savings for the consumer. And that tells us what businesses we can get into and not get into. And that's really the theme and the message of O.co. And again, you may see our whole, depending on if the traffic keeps shifting over like it's shifting over, you may see it become not just our international brand, but it may even merge into expand into a more general brand for us within the U.S.
That traffic shift that you mentioned you're seeing, is that domestic as well as international, or is that mostly international at this point?
No, domestic, there's been a significant shift over as well in traffic.
Now, on Deep Capture, you've been following this Barry Minko case pretty closely. You know, he was charged in securities fraud against Lenar Corp. Could you talk a little bit about your involvement with that?
Well, we have, you know, deep captures, as you know, Matt, you guys at Benziger, who I very much admire. I've been quite critical of the New York financial media, but Benziger really seems to have a spine and is out there doing the reporting that the guys in New York seem to be afraid of doing. Deep Capture, I have a second hat I wear. I'm a journalist at deepcapture.com, and we've been studying this crew for years, and I can tell you exactly what's happened here. In October 2006, Barry Minko approached Sam Antar. Now, this is according to a deposition Minko gave in a case with USANA. Approached Sam Antar and said, Sam, why don't we work together? And you know both of these guys are both ex-felons. They both did jail time, and they both have presented themselves to the world as, well, I'm a reformed swindler, and now I know, it takes one to know one. That's the whole shtick. So in October 06, Minko approached Antar, according to a deposition he gave later. In April 07... Oh, and also in October 06, just a few days later, a guy named Gary Weiss presented Sam Antar to the world, sort of reintroduced him into the world, said, here's a guy everybody should know, and blah, blah, blah. So remember, the name is Minko, Sam Antar, and Gary Weiss. In April 07, something funny happened. Gary Weiss introduces a woman with another blog, a woman named Tracy Conan, saying, this is another woman that... These are sort of the C-list bloggers. Like, there's in Hollywood, there's A-list and B-list. Well, think C-list. These are the C-list bloggers. He introduces Tracy Conan, and she immediately starts blogging on Overstock and USANA. Well, 3 days later, Barry Minko's Fraud Discovery Institute, submits this sort of scurrilous smear hack job to the SEC saying USANA is a bunch of crooks. Well, that was all false and garbage, and it turns out, as a judge in Florida has just found, Barry Minko doesn't even really do any research. He's just, or the most cursory research, the judge described it, before he's out there saying, oh, a company's a scam job and such. There's a well-known New York hedge fund manager named Whitney Tilson, who Minko has said under oath paid him $40,000 to do this stuff on USANA. So now we get to Lennar Home Builders, and pretty much the same thing. Sam Antar wired Barry Minko, who's the guy who's now just about to plead guilty and get another 5 years. He already got a 25-year prison sentence when he was younger and got it after seven. He's according to his lawyer, he's about to take a plea and help the state and do five more years. Antar wired him $250,000. Now, originally, Barry Minko sort of covered in his testimony for Antar and said, well, he just did it as a gift. He liked me or something. Well, Lennar had a chance to depose Sam Antar, and we have sources that tell us that under oath, Sam Antar said, I had to pay Barry Minko that $250,000 as sort of a price to admission to this club. And he admitted that that's how he could get in on this game. Later, Minko paid Sam $30,000. Barry Minko paid Sam Antar $30,000 back for Sam Antar to support his Barry Minko's attacks on Lennar. And that's according to a pleading that Lennar has filed. So this is how there's basically a list of C-level bloggers, say Gary Weiss, Sam Antar, Tracy Conan, and they get fed material by this guy, Barry Minko. They actually have there's a woman named Michelle McDonough, who's another convicted felon, and she controls another sort of C or D list blogger named Floyd Schneider. And she worked for, she took up the cudgel on Blue Nile at the request of a guy named Dan Loeb, who's another well-known hedge fund manager, and also hired into that was a guy named Eric Kamel, who is the Wall Street Journal has reported he's kind of a dirty tricks guy that hedge funds hire. Eric Kamel also leaked. Eric Kamel works some part time in the Florida Attorney General's office, and he had access to, I think it was the North Carolina Attorney General, a case that they were about to bring, and he passed that information on. Anyway, you'll to his hedge fund patrons. So you'll see, for example, going up on Deep Capture very shortly, an analysis of when Barry Minko's stuff comes out. You can look at trading records of companies like USANA, and when they started seeing a lot of failures to deliver in their stock, and when they went on the Reg Show list, which was this list of companies who were seeing a lot of, let's say, manipulation in their stock, excessive failures to deliver. Say, in USANA's case, 3 days before Minko is delivering this Fraud Discovery Institute report to the SEC accusing USANA of a bunch of smears against them, 3 days before he delivers, the deliveries go wild and USANA goes on the Reg Show list for the first time. That confirms that there are hedge fund patrons behind these guys, and that's a repeated pattern. So just before their stuff hits, there's always these great big spikes in the failures, which it makes clear that these guys are really, the basic game plan is they're being paid to do hatchet jobs, to come up with smear reports. The hedge funds paying them do these, trade it, know that they're coming. They're actually paying, the hedge funds are paying these guys to come up with these smear reports. They're then putting, they're trading in front of them, and then the smear reports get fed to a group of compliant bloggers, like these C-list bloggers, who just then write, go on message boards and write blogs, thousands of blogs, just smearing the companies. But it's all fed. The key thing to understand about guys like Barry Minko and Sam Antar, it's all fed out of the hedge funds.
What about Whitney Tilson then, with the $40,000 payment there?
I think it's very interesting. I've asked Whitney Tilson for an explanation. Why would he be paying $40,000 to a swindler, and now a swindler, felon, and now a second-time felon, because he's pleading guilty, like Barry Minko? And Whitney won't answer. I think that, Whitney's answer is going to be, well, I paid Barry Minko to do research. Well, when Whitney Tilson, who is a allegedly legitimate New York hedge fund manager, goes out and raises money with his clients, does he say that he's making his investment decisions based on the work of, guys like Barry Minko? I seriously doubt it. And in fact, what's clear when you get into this is this isn't about research. This isn't about somebody. Whitney Tilson doesn't pay. Nobody's paying these guys this kind of money to hear what their thoughts are on the economy or what their analysis is of companies. They're paying these guys to write to come up with sort of scurrilous smears against companies, and then the hedge fund that's doing the paying can step in front of it and short it and buy a bunch of puts and do a bunch of naked short selling, which is what explains the FTDs and the appearance on the Reg Show, just 3 days before their guy like Barry Minko or Sam Antar takes the report to the SEC. And they simultaneously get this little coterie of C-list bloggers like Gary Weiss, Tracy Conan, Sam Antar to repeat all the smears on message boards and in their own blogs. That's the fix is in, and that's the game. And not only is this all thoroughly documented, I think, on Deep Capture and depositions and so forth, and there's a lot more about to come up. There's a lot more about to be published probably this weekend. But remember, this is what Barry Minko, according to his lawyer, is pleading guilty to having just taken part in all this. So this isn't some wild speculative theory. He's now taking another five years in prison and, according to his lawyer, cooperating with the authorities, which one can only hope mean that he's ratting out Sam Antar and Weiss and these other people and explaining how the whole thing works. And I'd love to, one can only surmise why a legitimate hedge fund manager like Whitney Tilson would pay him $40,000, but Whitney won't answer. And I'd also love to know Dan Loeb's involvement. Dan Loeb uses there's a cutout. There's a woman named Michelle McDonough who takes care of a bunch of the stuff for Loeb, but and she's another convicted, did a year in prison, I believe. And so there's this whole network of these sort of dirty operatives that work on behalf of hedge funds. And I think if Barramico rolls, that'll start exposing this whole crew.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see how all this shakes out and if it'll, you know, end up eventually spreading some light on some more of this sort of activity that's going on. It's been a while since we spoke with you last. I think there's been some pretty significant developments in your own case against the prime brokers since we last spoke. In December, you settled with several prime brokers, and you also expanded your case against the remaining two, which are Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs, to include RICO charges. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, you ought to view it, this is all very much connected, because for these hedge funds to do these kinds of things, it only makes the reason they're doing it, the reason they're taking all these effort to manipulate a stock down and do this kind of thing is so they're shorting it and they're naked shorting it. Well, the naked short, you really need a nudge and a wink from your prime broker. And so that's the prime broker's involvement. And then the prime brokers can sort of lay off the dirt that would otherwise be what they're guilty of by laying it off to market makers. So it's a way of sort of, there's not necessarily one pair of dirty hands, the dirt gets scattered all through the system. So go back, we actually had two cases, and I'll go back a few years. We had another case against a hedge fund named Rocker Partners and a phony research shop in Phoenix called Green and Analytics. And it was exactly the same scheme as Minko's. And they printed all this garbage about us. It was all false. They ended up retracting it. We ended up getting paid. Well, think of it this way. When Giuliani went after Michael Milken in 1990 or so, you know, you have this whole ecosystem, and you got to prosecute by starting at the bottom. You start with the krill. You crunch up the krill. You move your way up the food chain till you get to the big guys. And that's what we did. We started with Gradient. We crunched them up, got to Rocker, crunched him up, got apologies and a public $5 million payment. We got into the prime brokers. We just settled with seven of them, who really were the seven of them paid us $5 million back, I think, in December to get out. So now we've collectively been paid $10 million. And that's just, let's say, that's the part we've been publicly paid, $10 million as we move up the food chain. But now we're up to the, and what's left is the whales. And the whales are Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch, which is now a division of or a subsidiary of Bank of America. And it's very clear. Well, all I can say is Goldman Sachs held off for years turning over some documents until they were finally forced to in November and in November of 2010. And our lawyers reviewed them, and they pretty quickly came to me within a month, or, you know, a million pages or something, but they came to me within a month and said, "This, we now have a RICO action. It's clear that Goldman Sachs, this isn't some out-of-control guy on a trading desk somewhere. This was a approved at the highest level. This was an organized crime that Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch organized. A couple, by the way, along with a couple sort of dirty market makers in New Jersey who themselves have been fined, I think $15 million, but for their involvement in this, and that they've paid up, and they're taking the fifth in their depositions with us. So, but who we're really after is Goldman. Merrill are the schlumps. Merrill are the wannabes. Goldman Sachs is the evil empire, and my lawyers are said, look, this is an fishing trip. We now have thorough documentation that Goldman Sachs just organized this crime, and it's super clear. So we escalated to a RICO action, and it's RICO, which is racketeering, influence, and corrupt organizations. Nothing in that says you got to use a gun, and in those RICO statutes. And Goldman Sachs, again, it's the organization. It was an organizational matter, not a renegade, one guy out of control matter. So that's what makes it RICO.
But so what do you hope to achieve out of this case at this point? I mean, we've seen this several times in the past with these large investment banks. They settle out of court, and they don't have to admit any sort of guilt or wrongdoing. I mean, isn't it eventually going to come down to potentially a cash settlement out of court?
No chance. No chance. That would be treason, in my view. it really would be treason. These guys are enemies of the Republic. They have to be exposed. So this has to get to court, and this has to get in front. You know, juries really have two functions. One is fact-finding, and it's a sort of wisdom of the crowds. You set it, put a bunch of evidence in front of 12 strangers, and they find the facts, and that's one purpose. But in some cases, having a jury has a salutary effect simply because no one otherwise will ever know what the real truth is. In other words, if this were to settle, then everyone would always wonder, well, you know, this whole thing could be whitewashed. The whole thing could be whitewashed. Or, you know, our side would come out and say, see, that shows we were in the right. And Goldman would come out, or Goldman's shills in the press, like Bethany McLean, you know, Joe Nocera would come out and say, oh, well, this just shows that, you know, Goldman thought it'd be cheaper to pay than to fire or something. And it would never be settled. It's only by getting all this evidence in front of 12 Americans and their opinion, their stamp comes down on it, that the public can really know the truth. And so that we're not going to deny that. I will never vote for any settlement.
So no amount of money, no amount of money for you to walk away on this one.
No amount of money. $20 billion, I say, see you in court. Doesn't matter. This has to get in front of an American jury.
And you have a trial date set for December of this year, correct?
That's correct.
And so what are you doing in the meantime to prepare for that?
Well, I don't really have to do anything. We have our lawyers are doing a bunch of depositions, and they're working their way up through Goldman Sachs. And what's funny is Goldman Sachs plays this game. There's something called a person most knowledgeable, which is when you want to find out what a corporation did, you say, well, we want to know the PMK, the person most knowledgeable in your corporation, on this subject. And that's so you don't get in and do a deposition and each guy just sort of says, well, I don't know, that's someone else's department. That means that they're supposed to put somebody up who can answer the questions. And Goldman has played this game forever now, where they just designate somebody as a PMK, and the guy comes into the deposition, then every question he's asked, he says, I don't know, that would be somebody else. Well, what's eventually happened is that, you know, because each of them has pointed the finger up the chain at their bosses and we've just been able to grind up the food chain in these depositions within Goldman. And I think we've gotten farther in Goldman than anyone's ever gotten. We're way up their dress. And I think that what I'm only allowed to see, believe it or not, I'm only allowed to know about a sort of a thumbnail sketch of what we find. But I know that it's enough that what comes to court, I believe, is going to be worse than anything that's yet come out about Goldman by a long shot.
Do you think it's finally going to result in people going to jail?
Well, ours is a civil case, so we can't send anyone to jail, but the stuff that I think is going to be exposed about Goldman and what their business model really amounts to is something that the financial press will not be able to spin, will not be able to cover up, in part thanks to good independent folks like Benzinga. And so they just start looking silly by ignoring some things. And then once it gets covered in the press, I don't know if the government will ever act. That's not my wish I had a say in it, but I don't. But I know that all we can do is go through civil court and get this in front of 12 Americans.
Fair enough. Well, that's all very interesting. Patrick Burns, CEO of Overstock.com. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can find a link to do that right off of the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Vanya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.